Hello, and welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. I'm Bruce Edwards. The story behind this episode started when a whale conservationist put a simple question to an economist.
So, Ralph, how much do you value your next breath? And life has never been the same since.
Yeah, and it's true from my perspective. We went to see the whales from a small boat, our research boat, together. And then this whole thing of, you know, he's an economist. No.
And while these two people have very different professions, they're kindred spirits in a way. Both love whales, and both are driven to find ways to reduce the carbon in our atmosphere that's warming the planet and threatening our ecosystems.
So my name is Michael Fishback, and I'm the executive director of the Great Whale Conservancy, and our mission is to protect the plight of the world's great whales. Those are all of the large whales in the world.
Great, thank you. And Ralph?
So I'm Ralph Shammy, been at the IMF for 20 years. What he didn't tell you is that he was a very famous tennis player.
No, I feel like I need to ask you about that. How did you go from tennis to whales?
Well, I was a hiking guide in the middle, and the getting away from tennis, I was very interested in nature. So I lived up in Vermont, and I actually started a business that took people on guided hiking trips in various places around the Northeast, including Canada. And we had a trip in Quebec that started in old Quebec City and went downstream the St. Lawrence River. And it went down as far as the whales come up. And over the years of leading that trip, I had exposure to both the whales in the estuary of the St. Lawrence and the people, the Quebecois, that worked and studied them. We became very friendly. One thing led to the next, and obviously it all led to me sitting at the International Monetary Fund podcast room.
That's amazing. And I have to tell you, I was born and raised in Quebec City.
In Quebec City.
That's right.
One of my favorite places, and certainly the most beautiful city in North America, in my opinion. I have dear friends there. Love the place.
So there are lots of bad things happening in the environment, both on land and in the oceans, for a lot of reasons. Both of you are very much focused on carbon. And it seems that economists are very interested in carbon these days.
Yes.
Ralph,
yes.
Why are economists so into carbon?
Well, because, of course, it's not the carbon in of itself, it's the implications of the carbon for people's health, if you like, and from that to the economy, the impact on the environment, and of course that's going to affect the economics of any country, and this is where the IMF comes in. It affects the macroeconomy, and that's our remit.
It's an element tied to the environment, but that's something that economists can sort of wrap their heads around.
Exactly, and there's been a lot of work before we arrived at this. People have been, you know, they understand the impact of carbon, as scientists and economists have figured out, and so then they look at the value of clean air, if you like, and of course anything that has value has economic implications, and of course then it trickles to the economy, and of course this is where we come in.
And so, Michael, tell me about whales. The whale population. I mean, how many whales are there today as compared to perhaps 20 or 30 years ago? And how does this tie in to this conversation about carbon?
Well, I think the number of whales today, which are roughly 1.25 million whales, is related maybe more effectively to how many whales there were a little over a century ago, where we believe there were roughly 4.5 million. Maybe a little more, maybe a little less. And 20 to 30 years ago, we wouldn't have found a great difference in the number of whales to what we have today. The rebound is somewhat stagnant due to the unintentional deaths caused by certain human activities on whales. So there might be a few more whales today than there were 20 or 30 years ago, but compared to what we used to have, it would be a negligible increase. And the connection, the carbon connection, is very interesting, something I was not aware of at all when I started working with whales over a quarter century ago. First of all, whales have a lot of carbon in their body, in their large bodies. Second of all, the ocean is really the greatest carbon sink on planet Earth. Mm. It's the most effective and greatest puller of carbon out of the atmosphere, greatly assisting us in our fight against climate change and, you know, negating the burning of all the fossil fuels that we do. And in order for the oceans to do that, vast amounts of primary oceanic production have to be produced. A softer word for that is phytoplankton, primary ocean oceanic production. And everything that lives in the ocean is related to phytoplankton, because there wouldn't be anything else if it wasn't for phytoplankton. It's the base of the whole food chain. But it also happens to be the greatest photosynthesis mechanism on planet Earth, far surpassing all of the photosynthesis that's done by all of the vegetation on land. And it turns out the end of the story in short here is that the whales play a very significant role in the production of these vast phytoplankton blooms. And they do so by emitting critical minerals that the phytoplankton needs to bloom in their vast fecal plumes. They're big animals, and their fecal plumes are enormous, and they're full of the right stuff for phytoplankton. Mm.
And so, Ralph, you're very interested in this aspect of conservation.
Right.
And economists love this word spillover.
Yes.
Right? And there are pretty significant potential spillover benefits of an increasing whale population.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
So the first question when I heard the story, and I heard it for the first time from Michael and his wonderful partner, Heather, was at a dinner, and they're talking about something that I had never heard before, that the whales have something to do with the carbon. Now, of course, I know the literature on the carbon taxation and what we do in order to, you know, sort of help countries not to cut down their forests. So I was sitting there and listening to this conversation, and then I heard what Michael is saying, which is, actually it was Heather then saying, 50% of all oxygen comes from the oceans, from the phytos. That's every other breath. And I remember Heather looking at me, "So, Ralph, how much do you value your next breath?" And I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful to write a paper about that? And then, of course, I started asking, well, so how much carbon do these whales capture? And make a long story short is, well, they capture on their bodies, as Michael is saying, at on average, and that's just is about nine tons of carbon, and that's equivalent to 33 tons of carbon dioxide. Now let me give you sort of a perspective. Okay, a tree captures 48 pounds of carbon dioxide per year. It takes a tree about 40 years to capture one ton. This creature, on average, because some are much bigger than the average, obviously, carry on them 33 tons of carbon dioxide.
Wow.
And when they die, they sink to the bottom of the ocean. And that carbon is sequestered for a very, very long time at the bottom of the ocean.
So, yeah. Michael, maybe you can explain this process or phenomenon called the whale pump.
The whale pump. Yeah, it's actually a very simple process. The whales come to a given area consciously. They know where they're going. And this is an area where there are seasonal upwellings bringing the nutrients of the ocean, the nutrient layer of the ocean, or the nutrient mass of the ocean, lives on the bottom of the ocean. It's all the things that die and all of the excrement of the things that are alive that rain down on the bottom of the ocean. When certain seasons come to certain parts of the ocean, there is an upwelling, and those nutrients are brought to the top. When they're brought to the top, they need to mix with phosphorus, iron, and nitrogen, these critical minerals, in the upper level or the photic zone of the ocean. That's where the whales come in. They deliver those minerals. There are other sources of those minerals, like dust storms, river deltas, but whales are very critical. And then the result is phytoplankton blooms, which are consumed by the, they're plant algae-like life. They're consumed by the smallest animal like life in the ocean, which we call zooplankton and copepods. Next up are krill. If the whales are baleen whales, like the biggest whales, they consume the krill. And what happens after they consume the krill is eventually, when they consume enough krill, they poop. And they poop these critical minerals back into the photic zone of the ocean, and then the poop feeds more phytoplankton, which feeds more copepods and zooplankton, which feeds krill, which is consumed by whales, etc., etc. Eventually, the upwelling system breaks down due to seasonal and current changes, and it's over, and the whales migrate to the next place.
That's amazing. And Ralph, you did touch upon this just a moment ago, but so in the grand scheme of things, economists have put a value on carbon, or at least more or less, they're still discussing exactly how much it might, what it's worth. But what is the value of a whale or the population of whales in terms of carbon absorption?
Right. So if you allow me just to step back just a little to put things in perspective, what Michael is discussing is the contribution of the whales to the phytoplankton. And you have to understand the phytoplankton captures about over 9 gigatons of carbon per year. And that's about 37 billion tons of carbon dioxide per year.
That's way more than any rainforest.
Oh, that's four times the Amazon minimum.
Wow.
So really the lungs of the planet is actually in the ocean.
Wow.
And it shouldn't be a surprise, because most of Earth is actually water. And it's only one-fifth land, and the rest is all water. So when you realize that, it becomes less of a surprise per se. Anyway, so what I described earlier was what the whales carry on their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So they carry on their bodies. When they die, they sink to the bottom. That's one way they capture carbon and they keep it at the bottom of the ocean. The other way is through what they do through that pump in order to fertilize the phytoplankton, and there's where they play a key role in also capturing that carbon dioxide, that's humongous amount of carbon dioxide. That's partly due, of course, phyto benefits from many other factors, but including the whale action.
And so all those things contribute to their value towards the environment.
Exactly. So when I was listening to this conversation around Michael's table, it dawned on me that what we're talking about, you see, we all care about animals, but what the whale does is actually allowing us to survive directly. Because when you talk about whale and carbon in humans, I started thinking from an economist's point of view, right? Yeah. What is the value? Because when you tell the story of the whale, you're actually telling the story of us. If they survive, we survive. And if the whales die, that means the oceans are not functioning properly. And if the oceans are not functioning properly, we die. This is where I started. Then I thought, okay, can we take this work that was done by scientists and Michael and others and take it into the public policy arena?
Mm-hmm.
So, but the first thing we had to do was, well, how much carbon do they capture? And working with Michael and other scientists who've been working on this, we were able to come up with the number that how much carbon dioxide does a whale actually capture. Best estimate that we have based on the science that exists, and one can always improve on that. And then the next thing, okay, now that you know how much carbon, we need to put a dollar amount to get the attention of the policymakers. Where do you get that? Well, it turns out that literature already exists. So we went to the World Bank dashboard, and they have carbon, pricing of carbon per country. And in some countries, within certain regions, it differs. In Sweden, for example, the tonnage of carbon is $120. In some other countries, it's $2.
Mm-hmm.
So we figured on a sort of an average price, if you like. And then the next thing is, how are we going to value this whale? Now, here's the trick. You could multiply the price times the quantity, and you get a number. But that number, that dollar amount, you're benefiting from that on a yearly basis for the life of the whale. Think of the whale, I'm a finance guy, so I think of it as an asset that gives me value. But that value accrues over the lifetime of the whale. Well, what is the lifetime of a whale? According to Michael and others, some of them live 200 years, some of them live 70 years, 60. So we took a 60 year, although that's really...
Sort of on the low end.
Yeah, on the low end. Everything we did was actually on the low end. Mm-hmm. And then you look at this annuity, if you like. So you're calculating, in a sense, the present value of an annuity, something that yields you value over 60 years, and you discount it to the present. And we used a really low discount, you know, factor. And what you come up with, the value of a whale, is in the millions of dollars. 2 million at a minimum.
And how much is a whale worth on the market?
Now that's the interesting part. Thank you for asking that. On the whale, so as we understand it, is as we looked at some of the reports, the whale on the market, and they're pricing it based only on its meat value, is $24,000. Hmm. So now, suppose you have a country where people are consuming whale meat, because, and the value of the whale meat is $24,000. If you were to come to them and say, by the way, that whale is actually worth a couple of million dollars, that means the plate of meat that you're eating is going to cost you now $10,000. I'm sure the demand would disappear.
But that value, the real value that we're talking about is sort of on the global scale. And as you mentioned in your article,
yes.
Now we're looking at whales as being a public good.
Yes.
So Michael, what are your thoughts about the whale population being a public good?
Well, I think this is one of the arenas where I've learned a lot from Ralph. While I might have known that whales moved around a lot, I paid a lot more attention to where they move around since speaking with Ralph, because it is true that almost every large whale in the world at least switches countries, and in some cases over the course of a year of its life visits a number of countries, and in certain cases actually visits different continents. Specifically, we can talk about the South Atlantic. There are definitely humpback whales that have been seen, individuals in West Africa and in Eastern South America. So there is no question, as we start to look at the money or the financial aspect of whales and the value of whales, that they are an international commodity of good, and nobody really should have the right to ever kill a whale without running it by a lot of other nations.
I mean, if I may go back, because this is an important point. See, we're observing, I'm with Michael on his boat, and we're observing the blue whale, if you like, in the Sea of Cortez. And I'm asking Michael, where does this whale go? And goes places, doesn't stay there. And so if you're thinking of the whale is giving all this benefit to the people in this area, in the area of, let's say, Baja, but that same whale is going somewhere else and doing the same thing. So, and we're all benefiting from it. So in a sense, it's a public good, but it's an international public good.
Okay, so when we're talking about public goods,
yes.
We also are talking about the tragedy of the commons.
Yes, exactly.
So remind us what that is and how this plays into that.
Yes, the tragedy of the commons, I mean, these are goods that have so much benefit to everybody, but when you ask people to contribute to a public good, like when you know what, I listen to NPR all the time, right? And suddenly NPR says, hey, we need your help. And suddenly people turn off their, you know, switch off their radios and they want to listen to CNN or whatever else, because the individual never is able to completely internalize the value of that good to everybody else. And rightly so. I can value it with respect to what I get out of it, but I surely cannot be expected to understand fully or grasp fully its impact on everybody else. And that's why you cannot leave it to an individual or a country to value the whale itself. So when we say the whale is worth in millions of dollars, that's to all of us. And that's why in certain countries it's 24,000, because they may not perhaps yet figured out that the whale is helping their environment, just looking at it from a meat perspective. Whereas everybody else around them is saying, no, this creature, this beautiful creature, is helping us live.
So from the economic perspective, yes. How do you create incentives for people to actually feel ownership and feel motivated to contribute to this common good?
Well, the first thing is information. I mean, this for me was new. So the idea, in the case of the whales themselves, is to allow people the time and the space to understand that the story of the whales, aside again, ethically they ought to be allowed to live freely and live their full life. But from a purely selfish human point of view, their survival is our survival. So the first thing is to make that point. The second one is to give it a value, because whenever you want to take this to the public policy point and say we need to do this, the first thing the politicians and the others are going to tell you, how much will this cost? So what you always have to do is show the benefit. And the benefit way outweighs that cost. Now, of course, the benefit is, as you said, it's to all of us. It's diffused among all of us. But if all of us care about this, because this is our story, then there's a very famous theorem in economics, is Coase's theorem, says, if I care about something really, really a lot, and you care about it less than I should be willing to compensate you for looking after it on my behalf, if you like.
Like NPR.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And it works. And that's why public goods always, when I used to teach public finance, first welfare theorem is you need to subsidize public goods. If it's a public bad, you tax it. That's why we tax carbon, because it's a bad. It's a public bad. So we put a tax on it. But if it's a good, and in this case the whale, you have to subsidize it. You cannot leave it to the individual or the market.
So you're talking about subsidizing.
Yes.
Now, we've talked a lot about how subsidies don't work.
Yes.
So why should they work for when it comes
Wonderful.
To the whales?
Wonderful. Subsidies don't work when they are, first of all, when they're not targeted. Whom are you trying to help with the subsidy? If you say, well, I'm subsidizing fuel because I want to help the poor. Well, subsidizing fuel consumption only helps the rich, because if I have a 12-cylinder car, I'm the one getting the most of that subsidy. So if you really want to help the poor, you should target the subsidy to the poor.
So how do you do this with whales?
In this case, so what we're saying here, what we have is we need to protect the whales. We need to help them come back, and Michael can talk what would it take and how difficult this would be, is going to be if we don't move and move quickly. But one way could be that you create a fund, and there will be contributions to this fund, and that fund goes to defraying the cost of mitigation. It's just one idea. There are many other ideas. So, for example, you want a poor country to undertake certain activities in order to help protect the whales, and this poor country may not have the means. Well, the rest of the world should be able to come in, just like we pay countries that have Amazon forests not to cut down the Amazon. It's very similar in that same vein, and I'm sure human creativity will come up with all kinds of ways of mitigation. But the first thing is to realize that we need to act, and we need to act now, because the oceans, and Michael can talk to this better than me, are dying. I mean, and that's not news to anybody. Just look at the UN reports and other reports.
So, Michael, what will it take to actually let the whale population grow as it was?
Well, I personally have high hopes that what it will take is paying attention to the economic value of whales. Now, I will get right here in short order into what it physically will take, but we have failed the whales now for the better part of 50 years. Those of us that were alive back in the 70s will probably remember the Save the Whales campaign. While that campaign, which was largely successful, was underway, things like container shipping and cruising and the movement of goods around the world was growing and growing and growing. And we were not aware of the areas where the critical habitat of the whales were, typically seasonally critical habitat areas. And in many of those areas, there is an intersect between the traffic lanes or the shipping lanes and the areas where the whales are feeding. And the whales have not evolved, the great whales, to be able to avoid these ships. So one of the most important things that we can do is we can stop the activities that are killing the whales and change, not fight the shipping industry and say they shouldn't be here, to work with them to find alternative ways, locations and times and speeds and other things of their travel that will be more friendly. Secondarily, another critical issue is entanglement. We have to be far more responsible with the gear that is used to catch fish, where it is used, when it is used, and what type of material is used. Too many whales die in an entanglement. And then, of course, we have, you know, this is a big problem. These are big animals, and the solutions are complex. Another big one is marine plastic debris, because the toothed whales in particular, not so much the baleen or the filter feeding whales, the toothed whales do not seem to be able to always differentiate between prey and a plastic bag. And we have too many times found a dead toothed whale on the beach full of plastic. And of course, the other big one is seismic testing. These animals see by sound. They live in an element that is very conducive to sound traveling long distances. In fact, some of the largest whales, we are sure, can communicate directly with each other over 1,000 miles away. So we have too much acoustical pollution from ships and seismic testing in particular that can either harm their ability to communicate with each other or, in extreme cases, rupture their eardrums and kill them. And that has been documented.
So to wrap this up, the United Nations, not too long ago, came out with a set of goals that they call the Sustainable Development Goals. And obviously, the environment is at the top of the priority list. Given the potential contribution or the contribution that whales make toward capturing carbon in our atmosphere, why do you think it's such a hard sell? I mean, you've been working hard, very hard over the years to gain public awareness about the whales. Why is it so difficult?
Well, it's really very simple, and that's why I'm so excited about working with Ralph on this project. My strategy has been largely working with the industry and not working as much with the international bodies like the UN and the International Whaling Commission and groups like that. Not as much. I'm not opposed to working with them, but more directly with the industry, where if we can get a change to happen, they can really help to make it happen, almost insist that it happens or just do it. And the thing that always stops us isn't that they want to kill whales. They don't want to kill whales. It isn't that they don't understand me when I give them the solution to a particular problem in a particular area. This thing that always stops us is money. Every single time, it's money. We would do this, but we have people that we need to answer to, and this is going to cost millions of dollars, and there needs to be more pressure coming from here or there. It's a money thing. And we have never had an economic response to the industry. And we are now speaking their language, and I think we're on to something big.
So I think you have a partner here, and not to put too much pressure on you, Ralph, what do you think the chances are of bringing up public awareness as to sort of making the economic case, the business case out there, and making conservation of whales an economic priority that the world should take on? What do you think the chances are of that actually happening?
I would hope that with this one is actually the chances have improved quite a bit. Again, as Michael alluded to, for the longest time, this discussion was taking place with people such as Michael, who spend their lifetime saying, look, watch out, and scientists who've been doing the science. Bringing it to the public policy space, suddenly there's always this budget envelope, and suddenly they say, well, you want us to do this. People directly see the cost, but there was anywhere could actually say, what is the benefit? So what we tried to do, and this is early work because we're trying to improve on whatever we've done so far, is to say, look, the benefit is tremendous. By the way, just something you said which reminded me, the managing director came out during the spring meetings and said, if we were to raise the carbon tax to $70, the consumption of the emission of CO2 would drop by 30%. Well, at $70, the value of a whale is over $7 million, okay? If you go to $70, that whale is worth a lot more than any any, you know, the pleasure of eating or basically hunting them or this and that. So, and that allows us to even, not even at 70, to say, look, there's so much benefit to all of us, and it's immediate benefit. I think for the longest time we were able to do this to the oceans, as we say in French, far from the ice, far from the heart. Loin des yeux, loin du cœur. It's just that I think the oceans for the longest time were far from us. And we thought it was just a sink. You throw your dirt into it, and thinking that somehow it's going to disappear into the I don't know where. But what Mother Earth is actually telling us, what you give is what you receive. If you send goodwill, it comes back to you in one form or another. You pollute, the oceans are saying enough. And I think the time is now. Every measure, every metric is saying the time is now. And what we're saying is that we're trying to give it a dollar amount only to get people to pay attention and to say saving the whales is saving us.
Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Yes, yeah, thank you.
Thanks for this opportunity.
That was Michael Fischbach, Executive Director of the Great Whale Conservancy, and Ralph Shamy, Assistant Director in the IMF's Institute for Capacity Development. Shamy's research paper on the important role whales play in carbon capturing is forthcoming. Meanwhile, his recent article on the topic is published in the online edition of Finance and Development magazine. Go to imf.org/FND or download the Finance and Development app to read it on your mobile device. And if you like this podcast, look for us on Spotify or Stitcher or your favorite podcast app. Just search for IMF Podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter @IMF_podcast. Thanks for listening.